I'm Marianne Barasonic, and my guest today is David Swanson. He's been a force in the anti-war movement for many years. He co-founded the website AfterDowningStreet.org and has been a consultant on the Kucinich presidential campaigns. He's just published a new book, War is a Lie. David, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for letting me. Good to be here.
Now, the premise of this book is not that just some wars are based on lies, but all wars are based on lies. All wars? Are there never any wars where people are attacked and really need to defend themselves?
Well, if another nation actually attacks yours, according to common understanding, you have a legal right to fight back. But that same war looked down on from up high is still an aggressive war from the other side. And of course, here in the United States, as the number one maker of wars in the world, as the nation that dominates the globe with 1,000 military bases in other people's countries, something nobody else does, as the nation that spends more on its military than the next 14 nations combined, we have a long history of pretending our wars are defensive, just as everybody else does from all sides of all wars, but of never having fought an actual defensive war. And so we go halfway around the globe to some impoverished nation and attack them and call that defensive, which is very, very different from actually fighting off an attack on your own nation.
But I thought all the wars came from the axis of evil, and we were just trying to fix things.
Well, yeah, so do a lot of people, but fortunately they're in a minority now, and we're the majority. We don't always know that and tell each other that, but we are. And the problem is that we aren't in that majority when it counts, right? When we went into Iraq, a majority of Americans wanted to. Now a majority says we never should have, and the same with Afghanistan. We have done a very good job on Iran for several years now, and we don't appreciate that success and congratulate ourselves enough, and we get despairing about having any impact. But that is a very, very encouraging development. But can we get to the point where they understand that they can't launch any new wars? Because we will resist them when it happens, when it matters, not years later.
Okay, well, let's get back to your book, War is a Lie. You know, the idea that there are no good wars. What about World War II? It's often described as the good war, but you don't see it that way. Didn't the effort by the Allies to defeat Nazism, you know, mean something? Wasn't that worthwhile? How should the U.S. have handled Hitler's aggression?
Well, efforts to defeat Nazism or to prevent it arising in the first place are absolutely excellent, but what kind of efforts, and are they worse than the disease that they're curing? It's a very, very odd situation here in the United States, where we have this military that completely dominates the planet. We've failed to be at war in any significant way for 14% of our existence as a nation. We are always at war after another every year. And yet, when you ask people whether they oppose wars, they almost always immediately jump back 70 years to World War II and say, there, that proves you can have a good war. Well, I could give them that argument. I could say, yes, World War II was necessary and glorious, and there would still be no case whatsoever for keeping around the war machine. The fantasies of being taken over by Germans and Japanese are far more ludicrous now than they were then, and they were ludicrous then. And the idea that we can survive this war machine economically or environmentally or democratically or in terms of the blowback and the proliferation it's generating are absurd. So we don't have to prove that World War II was unnecessary and immoral in order to have an overwhelming case to shut down the war machine as we now know it. That being said, World War II is not what we tell each other it was. We pretend it was about saving the Jews from Hitler when it was nothing of the sort. That was not the real motivation for FDR and our government getting in, and it wasn't even the propaganda campaign. There were no posters about, you know, Uncle Sam wants you to save the Jews. It was strictly kept out, and we spent decades refusing to do what was needed, blocking legislation that would have let Jewish refugees into the country, turning ships around, providing weapons and financial assistance to the Nazis, and so forth. So if you go back, the further you go back in history, the easier it is to say what we should have done to avoid the war, right? I mean, if we had not ended World War I by punishing an entire nation rather than punishing the war makers, if we had not spent decades with Wall Street investing in the Nazis, we would have been able to take the proper steps. But even when you get to that crisis point where the government, which routinely says let's slow this down, let's stall, we don't need to act right away, demands absolute urgency, we must get into the war immediately, there's no reason to think that we had to. And people think that Gandhi was crazy for suggesting nonviolent resistance to the British or to the German people, and yet you saw German women get their Jewish husbands out of prison by protesting. You saw protests that began to scare the Nazis incredibly. You saw nonviolent resistance in Denmark and in the Netherlands that had a major impact. And Gandhi knew that it would have cost thousands of lives. But what we did, the course we took, cost 70 million lives. And if that liberated concentration camps that let some hundreds of thousands or millions of people free, that was a wonderfully beneficial side effect of what was otherwise the worst action in human history that we have yet to recover from, as it has created this war economy, this war state, and has justified 75 years of warfare. I don't think we should leave the topic alone, and I don't think we should allow the routine excuses that don't fit with what happened at the time.
Yeah, but what you're saying is there were other tools that could have been used to short-circuit what happened there, and instead of using those tools, the U.S. just went into adding to the war.
That's exactly right, which is not to say that the Nazis were not an imperial war criminal state, or the Japanese for that matter. It is to say that the U.S. government very much hungered for war and empire as well. We were not innocent bystanders dragged reluctantly into the game of war. We were a nation that spent the interlude between the two world wars building alliances and antagonizing potential rivals and growing an incredible military, building bases and airstrips around the Pacific, antagonizing the Japanese. And when it came time that Roosevelt wanted the Japanese to attack, provoking the Japanese, joining in China's war with Japan, imposing sanctions and blockades that were destroying Japan's economy and so forth, which is not to excuse an attack on Pearl Harbor, but the excuse of that to get us into the war in Europe is already pretty tenuous. And then when you come to understand that attack was provoked and desired, it looks different from the simplistic history that we get in elementary school.
But it was incredibly effective propaganda. I remember my grandmother was extremely opposed to war, she said, when she saw the results of the First World War. But by the time the Second World War came around, she was very proud that her sons were going to serve. So they had a whole propaganda campaign that was extremely effective. And this seems to precede every war. But it's in your book, you go over the different lies that are used. And it seems like the same lies are used over and over again. And people seem reluctant to believe that they're being lied to. Why is that?
Well, we do seem reluctant, many Americans, to believe that, because many Americans still put a certain faith in in their government and refuse to believe that it is quite as evil as it appears to be. When it comes to any other issue, when it comes to Social Security or taxes or schools or health care, a huge number of Americans passionately believe that the government is the root of all evil and you can't trust a word that comes out of any elected official's mouth. But when it comes to war, the cloak of patriotism and the xenophobia and the with us or with the evil enemy categorization results in people having a much stronger desire to believe the more blatant lies that come out of Washington, D.C. And so you'll see the same people that refuse to believe a word that anyone says about health care swallowing the most outrageous nonsense and believing they thought it up for themselves when it comes to war, because they don't want to believe that that government officials are using something as holy and sacred as war to lie to them, or that the lies being told about the evil, demonized foreign dictators could be false or could be exaggerations or could be opportunist. And yet, all of that is quite clearly the case. We don't go around and launch wars based on who has the most evil dictator. We will never launch a war on Saudi Arabia. We will launch wars on all of its neighbors. And you can't rank the nations in terms of their internal hostility to human rights and find any correlation with where we launch the wars. We pull out certain types of propaganda to talk about the evils of other nations or peoples or rulers when we want a war for other reasons. And a lot of the lying is not explicit lying about this missile was launched at this time on this day, but racism and religious bigotry and xenophobia and lies about the value of secrecy and the utility of hostility in our foreign relations that people have all internalized, and so they don't think of it as anything to question at all as to whether it is accurate or a lie.
Okay, and this is Political Perspectives. My guest is David Swanson. We're talking about his book, War is a Lie. And we will be taking phone calls, so if you want to give us a call, 503-231-8187. David, let's talk about this issue of secrecy. In the last couple of decades, the powers of the president have increased, and the amount of secrecy in the government has increased tremendously. So how do we counter this? I mean, we don't even have anything to we don't even have insight into what the government is doing.
We don't, and when anyone comes along and gives it to us, we resent that and want them assassinated or incarcerated, according to the corporate media and its polling. You know, not you and I and or everyone listening, but a majority of Americans apparently thinks that WikiLeaks has done something criminal. The fact is that we know next to nothing about what our government is up to, and Thomas Jefferson, my neighbor here in Charlottesville, and others who put this country together thought that that was the fundamental guardian of the future of our representative government, was in an informed public. And here we are in a situation where we don't even want to be informed and resent being informed. Presidential powers, as you say, including the power to keep everything secret, have grown dramatically, exponentially through the past 2.25 centuries, and are growing very, very rapidly as we speak, as the president is formalizing and legalizing new abuses that were secretive crimes when George W. Bush was in town and are now official policy, including the policies of kidnapping and lawless imprisonment without charges or trial, including policies of assassinating American citizens. It's hard to imagine where else we can go, how much closer you can get to absolute power in the hands of an individual, which is what was used to justify the American Revolution, than where we are right now, with Congress and the media and everyone else bowing down before presidential prerogative.
Well, and what we seem to have is this pattern where there's a Democratic president who is popular and lays the groundwork for the Republican coming in and then picking up where the Democrat left off and making a bunch of laws. So what's really scary is not so much that Obama continued the Bush policies. That's scary in itself. But it's like, what is Obama laying the groundwork for?
Well, indeed, he's laying the groundwork for absolute power put in the hands of individuals. And I can think of some particularly crazy individuals who could have that power within a couple of years. And that is extremely frightening. But it can't get that much dramatically worse than where it is right now. With this president and this Congress expanding our military and engaging in more secret wars with special forces, and you know it's WikiLeaks that's showing us that we have a war happening in Pakistan. We have Pakistan and Yemen lying to the world with us about the wars we're engaged in their countries, and you know we have these wars without any debate whatsoever, and that looks like the future of the launching of wars, even major scale wars, as the incoming Republican House, which agrees with this president on everything when it comes to warfare, and which wants presidential powers in warfare expanded regardless of who the president is at the moment and whether they despise him and think he was born in Africa. And so there's talk of a new authorization to use military force to replace the one from 2001, this unconstitutional legislation giving a president, any future president, the ability to make wars. And this would take out the now routinely violated clause that says there must be some connection to the attacks of 9/11. It would add in powers to strip away civil liberties in time of war, as is now routinely done. And time of war, of course, would be defined as without limitation in time or space. So we are really undoing the Constitution in dramatic ways and in formal, open ways, whereas a lot of these innovations were more secretive when Bush was in town.
Okay, and we're going to open the lines here. Good morning, Mitchell.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for your talk this morning and for taking calls. I'd like to ask a little bit about the situation America finds itself in today and how we were led into war. And you can't really touch any of the evil that's being done to our country right now without bringing up 9/11 and the fact that the people who perpetrated it, the evils, whoever they may be, are still running around. And we're more worried about letting, like, gays into the military than to tracking down the truth. America will never get over this wound as long as it is festering underneath. It has to be exposed, and it has to go back to 9/11. And I'll take your comments off air. Thanks.
Well, what do you think, David? If we had a real investigation of 9/11, do you think that would make a difference?
Oh, I think it could, and I think we might someday. And there's no telling what may come out days or months or decades from now. I don't think that that anything is the silver bullet that will, in and of itself, end the course we're on. I think there are many things that could be helpful. But I think that when you have a crime like September 11th, there ought to be accountability for the government under which it happened, and there ought to be prosecution of the criminals. Instead, We had our White House tell the Taliban, both before and after 9/11, that we didn't want bin Laden put on trial in a third country. We wanted bin Laden free to roam the earth as a justification for war. War in Afghanistan, war in Iraq, war around the world. Even at this point, even if bin Laden were dead, they have developed in al-Qaeda, in this notion of extremist Muslim terrorism, the absolutely most perfect propaganda for war that there ever has been. The communist conspiracy was capable of ending, and it ended, and they were at a loss. Terrorism, defined as resistance to whatever the U.S. war machine is doing, even completely nonviolent resistance, can never be proven to have ended. And the existence of a handful of mastermind terrorists around the world can never be disproven. This is the ultimate propaganda for eternal war. It has religious bigotry, xenophobia, racism,
and no end in sight.
And no limitations, yeah.
Okay, and we're going to take another caller. Good morning, Jack.
Hi. All of what you're saying about the global war of terror as being essentially the biggest psychological operation that has ever been perpetrated is something that I find tremendous support for in terms of confirming it. The confirmation of this can be found in many, many places. It's not hard to find. And the reason I'm calling is because I heard you citing the WikiLeaks as being maybe something on the order of a silver bullet. And I would recommend that you look deeper, and that possibly, and this is being brought up in many places, and I'm sure you're aware of it, that the WikiLeaks themselves may also be one other facet of this psychological operation.
You know, that's a really interesting point, because I have been reading some stuff that says that if you go through what's come out of WikiLeaks, that a lot of it is pointing towards an invasion of Iran. Do you have any opinion on that, David?
Yeah, I think that WikiLeaks has shown that that claims about Iranian missiles being able to reach Europe were debunked. I think WikiLeaks has shown that it is lunatics like the dictator of Saudi Arabia that are pushing us into an aggressive war on Iran, at the same time that WikiLeaks has shown Saudi Arabia to be the number one sponsor of the terrorism against which all of these wars are supposedly justified. I think that WikiLeaks has exposed our lies about a coup in Honduras, about an Ethiopian invasion of Somalia, about our embassies around the world serving as salesmen and saleswomen for U.S. weapons factories, about our crackdowns on Spain and Germany and Italy and England's investigations and commissions looking into our war crimes and our torture. I think that the more and more you look into WikiLeaks, you see an endless parade of evidence of war crimes, many of which we knew about and others of which are brand new and lied about continuing up until this day, including the existence of our ground war in Pakistan. So I think that there are ways that people should be cautious about WikiLeaks. One of them is that what diplomats say to each other in cables is not necessarily true. It's just what diplomats say to each other in cables. They all may be wrong. They may be trying to deceive each other. So, you know, but also much of this is being filtered through the corporate media. WikiLeaks is allowing the New York Times and other newspapers in Europe to vet these before they're published, for the most part. And so the fraction of this pile of cables that has thus far come out has gone through a particular filter that we should have in mind as we're looking at this evidence. But beyond that, the articles and the much less the talk on television about what has come out is incredibly misleading. And you ought to, at the very least, go to The Guardian rather than The New York Times. And beyond that, go to the cables themselves and look for yourself, because this is... This is not a propaganda stunt. This is not something that the CIA wanted put out. This is evidence of a war machine and of our State Department being an absolutely subservient partner in the war machine.
I would counter that. With one thing in particular. There is a journalist. His name is Gordon Duff. He's the senior editor at I believe it's called Veterans Today, and upon analyzing the first of the leaks that came out, he and his staff, some of his staff are Iraq vet, and they actually found cables that they themselves authored while they were in the field. And their first hint about this was they saw that their own cables had been doctored, altered, and angled in such a way to pointedly suggest some of the points that you've made, painting Iran as the great demon of the Middle East and things of that nature. And furthermore, when you talk about the mainstream media as having a hand in vetting and filtering, sorting, as it were, I think there's a really important thing to remember, and I don't know that it's changed so much in the last 30 years or so.
Okay,
but,
well, you know what?
Just let me finish, please. One last thing, and I'll be off.
Okay.
But if we recall what Colby said, the Central Intelligence Agency owns everyone of any significance in the mainstream media.
Right.
And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Okay. And I think that Gordon Duff information is really interesting to follow up on. And I'd like to take another caller now. Good morning, Brian.
Excuse me. Good morning. I think one way you might be able to make some impact, if at all, is to... against war is to focus on the environmental destruction that it inevitably brings in its wake, and the destruction of cultures, including indigenous American cultures, whom we should be looking to for wisdom. Two of my favorite examples are the island of Kaho'olawe in Hawaii, just off Maui, the tourist trap. Was used as a bombing range between 1941 and 1990 until the Hawaiians put a stop to it. And the
hey Brian, could you turn down your radio in the background?
Oh,
there.
Sorry. Yeah,
we're hearing this really interesting echo.
I had. No, it's the ghost of my Hamlet. did you get the bit about destruction of the environment and
cultures
and the island? Kaho'olawe off Maui was used from 1941 to 1990 as a bombing range, and it's still a danger.
Well, it seems like all of Iraq has been used as a bombing range.
But I'm just talking about native cultures within this country. And the other example, of course, is the Pine Ridge Reservation, which was pretty much declared a national sacrifice area because they found uranium and all sorts of stuff there. So that, to me, is one of the biggest things. People are more and more concerned about the environment, including some Republicans. And I think if you could hammer this point home, that the military equals environmental destruction, that might be a good tool. And that's all I really have to say, and I'll listen to the rest of the year. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call, Brian. Well, there is a lot of environmental destruction that goes on with war. I don't think that was part of what was covered in your book.
Well, you should read my book. I completely agree with Brian and say so at great length in Chapter 11 in the book, War is a Lie, and people can get it at warisalie.org and read about it. But I completely agree. You know, one of, as I mentioned earlier on this show, one of the ways in which we cannot survive this war machine is environmentally. I mean, we can't survive it economically, with civil liberties intact, in eight other ways, but environmentally, war is the number one destroyer of the environment. The U.S. military is the single institution that is the largest consumer of petroleum, and the damage that we do in weapons testing, in military training and operations, and in wars and occupations, leaves huge portions of the globe uninhabitable. Huge percentages of nations absolutely unusable because of landmines, not to mention depleted uranium and all sorts of other toxins with which we destroy the environment. And it's a very sad commentary to look at the bigger environmentalist organizations in this country that apparently think they should be good Americans not oppose wars when it is the biggest destroyer of the environment. And I think there are some efforts, including a group called Power Shift, that is planning new protests at the start of April in Washington and elsewhere, that are apparently somewhat open to working with the peace movement. And the partnership is an absolutely indispensable one in terms of money as well as in terms of partnering on environmental protection, because the wars is where all the money is going that could be going into green energy and jobs. And if we can come together as a peace movement and an environmental movement and say we want to defund the military that's destroying the world and we want to fund green energy jobs, it would be a truly powerful force.
Well, I think one of the ideas that really was interesting in your book was the one about how we think of a battlefield. Because when they talk about, you know, a battlefield on the news or in history books, there's kind of this image that there's, you know, two armies opposing each other and it's on a space where the battle is limited to. But that's no longer the case. And this ties into the environmental destruction. Let's talk a little bit about what the battlefield looks like today.
Yeah, well, you've said it right. I mean, wars are fought in people's cities and towns and villages, people's houses, people's shopping centers and churches and workplaces. That's where the wars are, which means that not only is the talk of a battlefield misleading, but the talk of civilian versus non-civilian casualties is very misleading. You know, our military in these wars is quite annoyed by the fact that it can't distinguish who is the enemy and who is the supposed beneficiary of these humanitarian efforts to bomb these places, because you can't tell anybody apart by looking at them, because they are simply the people who live there in Iraq or Pakistan or Afghanistan, and some of them are resisting in various ways, nonviolently or violently, and some of them are not, and some of them are collaborating. But to think that we have the slightest bit more legal or moral justification in attacking those who are resisting than in killing those who aren't is a problem, and it comes out of these old images of what war used to be. Over 99% of the victims of our wars, of the casualties of our wars, are non-Americans, and most of them are non-combatant civilians, as we still call them.
And that idea that you can't distinguish between the combatants and the non-combatants, the people who are resisting and who aren't, there's the problem with trying to define what a victory looks like, too, because it's not like there's a formal army. And you wrote in the book that you cannot win or lose a crime. You can only continue or cease committing it. And it's kind of like that's the way it is with the occupation, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the perfect point to follow. What we were saying, you have these old ideas of what war used to be, with two armies lined up against each other in different color uniforms, and one wins and one loses, and then you have you declare victory, and then you go and do the negotiation that you should have done before you killed all those people. Now that doesn't happen. There is nobody can tell you what victory would be. The late Richard Holbrook, who was in a Senate hearing earlier this year defending the war in Afghanistan and propounding all sorts of claims that he knew to be lies, couldn't come up with any answer when asked repeatedly by senators what victory was, what it would look like, how we would know it when we saw it, because nobody has come up with that. And yet, as everything gets worse by every measure, every year in Afghanistan, we have continuing reports on progress toward victory. And nobody can tell you what that is, because there isn't anything it can be. And so we have to, at some point, get out. And it's essentially a question of how much blood and how much treasure expended before we decide we've arrived at that point. Another item in WikiLeaks, you have the President of the European Union telling us that they know it's hopeless and pointless, and we're going to have to get out sooner or later, but they're in it in deference to the United States. Right. Never mind that the majority of the people of the United States want out as well. Europe is in it out of deference to, to be straight, to Barack Obama. And so we have to somehow, as you mentioned, get to the understanding of war as a crime rather than as a tool or as a campaign or as a sporting event. And yet we're miles away from that. Even people who oppose all the current wars don't think of war as something that like rape or torture or slavery should be banned in all times and places. They think of it as sometimes good and sometimes bad.
Well, we could end the wars by stopping the funding, and there was just recently another vote on it. And like the president of the European Union saying, well, we're doing this because in deference to the people of the United States, a lot of the excuses for continuing to fund the war is, well, we have to support the troops that are out there.
Right. This is why we have to get to the point where we stop wars before they start, or when we discover that they have started in secret, rather than years later. Because years later, we have a majority demanding that the wars be ended, and yet this great reluctance to end them, and reluctance on the part of some opponents of war to say that they should be defunded, even though that's how you end them, and reluctance on the part of Congress members to defund wars because they want to leave the war powers with the president, to whom the Constitution explicitly denied them, because there's all this talk about how the wars are for the benefit of the very young men and women killing and dying and suffering in them on our side, which is lunacy. And which is perhaps the strongest example of an argument for war that you only see in public propaganda and never once are able to find in private closed-door discussions by war planners, where the conversation often goes to, how do we get some American troops killed so that we can lock the country into this war, rather than, should we continue this war for the benefit of the troops who are in it, which makes no sense whatsoever. You're traumatizing and wounding and killing people. They are not benefiting from continuing or escalating a war.
Yeah. You quote Representative Alan Grayson of Florida, where Kurt Kelly was running against him, and at one point, Grayson said, you know, he wanted to stop the funding for the wars and he wanted to have the troops come home. And Kelly accused Grayson of wanting the troops to die. And Grayson, this was great. He said, yes, Kurt, I do want them to die of old age, at home, in bed, surrounded by their loved ones, after enjoying many Thanksgiving turkeys between them and now. And you want them to die in a scorching desert 8,000 miles from home, alone, screaming for help, with a leg blown off and their guts hanging out and their stomachs bleeding to death. Now, Grayson was reelected. He defeated Kurt Kelly. So doesn't this send the message that you can oppose the war and still keep your seat?
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but Grayson was roundly defeated.
He was. Oh, I kept looking on the web, and it said that he was the current representative for that district.
Well, it's not January yet. The people who get elected in November don't get their jobs until January, hence the lame duck session we're in. But Grayson was not defeated because he was a leader in opposing the lies that take us into wars. He was defeated because he was in a very difficult district where he had come in on Obama's coattails, and he was not given any support from the Democratic Party in Washington. He got a tremendous amount of support from the grassroots around the country, but he lost, and 55 to 60 other Democrats lost, almost all of whom were much worse than him on wars, most of whom were supporters of wars. Overwhelmingly, the people who lost were the blue dog Democrats, the lousy Democrats, my Democrat in Southern Virginia, the people who were in districts that resembled Grayson, but who had taken approaches to policy that varied dramatically from Grayson. And so the people who lost were people with that D word after their name, Democrats, and people in swing districts, and people who had come in because of Obama enthusiasm that had evaporated in the course of 2 years.
Well, that really puts a damper on what I thought was at least one good thing happening. And we're going to take another caller now. Good morning, Boris.
Good morning. I want to start off by saying that I'm finding this discussion of lead up to war involving American military increasingly frustrating, if not outright maddening, because I heard your guests and yourself discussing Pearl Harbor earlier and how it was fairly evident that the United States was responsible for goading Japan into an attack, and there is opinion out there that there was some awareness that the attack was coming, and it was not properly prevented. But my point here is that, you know, you make statements about how there are elements in our government that are perfectly capable of manipulating, if not outright orchestrating, the lead up to a war. And when it comes to present day events, in particular the events of 9/11, there's this reluctance to stick to that principle. All of a sudden, all the rules have changed, and we cannot look at any possible government collusion with the events of 9/11. It's just verboten. It's just too, we don't go there. And I'll give you an anecdotal example, and then I will take your response off the air. I was in a discussion with a person who described himself as a full-blown Marxist and had no particular love for the way that the government of this country does business. And yet when he was pressed on, you know, the questions that have never been answered about 9/11, he made a statement that I would not have believed had I not heard it with my own ears. He said, "I don't want to believe that my government would be capable of something like that." And I will leave it at that.
Okay. Well, first of all, Boris, I don't know where you got the idea that I personally didn't think that 9/11 could have been done by the government, because I think there's a lot of evidence that there was a lot of collusion there, and it was extremely convenient for them. And I would really like to see an investigation of what really happened. But David?
Well, I make the connection explicitly in Chapter 2, discussing Pearl Harbor and discussing 9/11. So the caller is apparently complaining about an author discussing his book, but hasn't read the book. And I think that we need an investigation. We haven't had one, but what the investigation cannot possibly show, because we already know it, is that our president on down were explicitly warned about 9/11 and took no steps whatsoever to prevent it. What an investigation cannot possibly show, because we already know it, is that our government is capable of things millions of times worse than 9/11. So the idea that we need to learn, we need to come to an emotional point where we can accept that our government might do such a thing, is just bogus. In fact, I discuss in the book plans of which we are aware that our government has cooked up over the decades to engage in acts just of that sort. That being said, we cannot know what happened on 9/11, much less can we verify all sorts of theories that are out there and claimed with absolute but completely baseless certainty until we know what happened. But discovering that what happened is exactly what any particular 9/11 theorist believes would in and of itself put an end to the war machine is just not credible. It could certainly help, but the thinking that says that, you know, killing 3,000 people in New York, it would be worse than the things we are openly aware of, such as killing 1.3 million people in Iraq, has a shade of racism to it that I am not attributing to the caller, but that I have seen repeatedly across the country.
Okay, and we've got another caller on the line. Joanne?
Yes, I haven't been listening to the program too long, but I was listening or watching, C-SPAN the other day, the Senate and House. They were, one of them was passing, a bill on the sex trafficking of children in this country. Do you believe that this kind of ugly behavior is a result of a country or countries that support and value war in the world, even the sex trafficking in the rest of the country? I'll listen off the air.
Oh, I don't know. I think that that it is by definition the result of a coarsening of culture, of people not caring for and respecting human life, and certainly a country that that uses the death penalty, that uses torturous forms of punishment, that uses warfare as the first resort in foreign affairs, is a country that is teaching people bad forms of behavior. You know, we get very upset. There's endless TV stories now about bullying in elementary schools, and yet the WikiLeaks cables involve nothing but bullying in our relationship to other countries, and certainly our relationship to each other, as depicted on cable news politics discussions, and our relationship to people who are not criminals, but people who are decreed to be enemy combatants. I think when you have the degree of lawlessness that you have in this country on both ends of the scale, where the biggest war criminals are not prosecuted, and where people are locked up, and organizations like ACORN are destroyed without any criminal charge, you're teaching lawlessness. Now, there may be a direct connection in some of what you're talking about. I don't know. Certainly, we have soldiers and mercenaries and mercenary companies in our wars involved in sex trafficking in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And it may be that some of that comes back. It may be that some of the lessons people are taught through the hell of warfare comes back in what they get involved in as veterans. I don't know. Certainly, if we were to move in the direction of peace and justice and the rule of law and democratic representation and concern for human rights, we would be moving in the right direction across all these issues.
You know, let's talk a little bit about some possible solutions here. You were just recently arrested in Washington, D.C. at an action in front of the White House. Can you talk a little bit about what that did and what we can maybe start thinking about doing to try to at least get the consequences of these wars to be more visible to people?
Well, I have been arrested a number of times at the White House opposing these wars. I was asked not to be last Thursday by Veterans for Peace, and instead I did communications. I made a movie. You can go to davidswanson.org or warisacrime.org and watch a video of what did happen. And 131 people, including many prominent people and mostly veterans. This was organized by Veterans for Peace. I am not a veteran, but I am a proud member of Veterans for Peace. It's a great organization. They organized this, and you know, I've just gotten off a swing of 4 or 5 days on a book tour through California, and I hear in about equal measure people complaining that nobody's doing anything, and people telling me the wonderful stories about what they're doing that nobody knows about. I think our most valuable resource right now are radio stations like this one, and websites and blogs, and our own cable and satellite television networks that are telling people what needs to be told, because there is a great deal of activism out there. It is effective. We need more of it, not less of it, but we don't know that it's happening, and so we aren't inspiring each other the way that we should be. It is perfectly enjoyable and often very effective to go to jail for a couple of hours in an effort to resist what's happening. You know, George W. Bush's new book recounts how in 2006, Mitch McConnell, the Republican minority leader, was coming to him and saying, let's get the troops out of Iraq before the election. And Bush didn't do it, but we were that close. We were an inch away from ending this lunacy. And we were running around telling each other we were absolutely powerless and having no impact. You know, they don't tell you how close you are until you get there. They don't announce that you've prevented a war on Iran every day that you continue preventing it. So we have to make these announcements to each other. We have to encourage each other. And, you know, the next time that Veterans for Peace goes to the White House, we have to have as many people there and doing solidarity actions in their cities at federal buildings, as many people did last week, as possible. January 15th is going to be the next big protest day in Washington, and I hope everywhere around the country, and this marks the anniversary of 20 years of U.S. warfare and sanctions and bombing on Iraq.
Okay, and we're going to take another call. Dale, good morning.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask your guest, is there any possible way to explain if there is any connection between our oil companies needing a pipeline going through Afghanistan to the warm water port and having a war there? I don't really understand.
Well, the war makers will tell you explicitly and openly that there is, and that it is one of the primary motivations for continuing the war in Afghanistan. It's not something that will be repeated endlessly on the front page or talked about on television ad nauseum. That's the case with most of the real motivations for wars. They're not secret, per se. They're just not endlessly repeated in saturation coverage. You know, I was at a RAND Corporation event in a Senate hearing room on Capitol Hill with Mr. Brzezinski, a former security advisor who has, you know, 30 years of Afghan blood on his hands, who openly listed that gas pipeline through Afghanistan as one of the primary motivations for the war in Afghanistan. Others include major military bases and the stationing of weapons and potentially the stationing of nuclear weapons in Afghanistan. These are people who want that spot on the globe strategically for their bases and their weapons and their troops, and who want that gas pipeline, not to mention the financial interests in profiting from the war itself and the electoral calculations and the whole package of real, rational, and irrational explanations for the war. But that one is certainly in there, and they make no secret about it.
Okay, and my engineer, Kurt, just told me that the bases are actually on the pipeline, not on the borders.
Wow. Well, so basically it's just greed and power that drives all this.
It is a lot of greed and power, and it is profiteering. These wars, the military has been privatized. The reconstruction industry scam has been privatized from the start. This is a very, very profitable business, and those profits now go without limit into election campaigns following the Citizens United ruling back on January 21st, and there will be events around the country marking that one-year anniversary coming up. It is a war driven by irrational motives of domination and power, very similar to Vietnam. That is, after you check off all the financial corruption that's driving the war, it's still very hard to explain the war because it is so disastrous for the economy as a whole. Ultimately, for many of the elites in the economy, it is disastrous electorally for the politicians in the long run. They ought to have learned this from Lyndon Johnson and other presidents who have taken a similar course, thinking it would help them and it hurt them, and yet they still want the war. I look in the book at war planners discussing Vietnam, and they're predetermined to stay in and escalate Vietnam, and they have to figure out why. They have to come up with a reason why for themselves, and then after that come up with reasons why to tell the public. And the talk is all of domination, of preventing rivals, of demonstrating their credibility. And credibility in warmonger talk means machismo. It doesn't mean honesty and accuracy. And so there are irrational drives that push these wars along that I go into in the book at some length, and by which I do not mean to imply that we can't do away with such drives as many cultures have.
Okay, so you had mentioned that there was a couple of actions coming up. Where can people go to get an idea of what's coming up?
Well, go to warisalie.org, which is the book's website, where you'll find the book in print and audio and ebook and Kindle, and you'll find links to where you can take action, including my website, which used to be called After Downing Street and is now called warisacrime.org, which is constantly listing activism from around the country and currently has some information right at the top about what's happening nationally in January.
Okay. Well, great. David, this has been Political Perspectives. I'm Marianne Barisonic, and my guest has been David Swanson, and we've been talking about his new book, War is a Lie. David, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Keep up the great work.
All right.